Today, answers matter more than ever before. That's why IBM is helping businesses manage customer questions with Watson Assistant. It's conversational AI designed to work for any industry. Let's put smart to work. Visit ibm.com/watsonassistant.
This is DiPietro, Canty, and Rothenberg.
We want to remind you, you can listen to us anywhere. Just click listen live at ESPNNewYork.com. Find 98.7 ESPN on the ESPN app or the TuneIn app, or simply tell your smart speaker, play ESPN New York. At 98.7 ESPN New York, we go where you go. I got to tell you guys, I was surprised, Chris, that Andy Dalton wound up with the Dallas Cowboys.
I was surprised, too, because I thought Andy Dalton would go to a place where he could have an opportunity to step in and be QB1, and it felt like that was more New England or Jacksonville as opposed to Dallas. But there is some uncertainty with the Dak Prescott situation. He is a Dallas native, so he's not a Dallas native, but he makes his home in Dallas. So, I mean, it's one of those things where it felt like for him, you could see why it made some sense for him to go there.
Yeah, a little fun fact, Dave. Santiago told me this, that Jerry Jones does have a ginger requirement on the team.
Because they so lost. He fills the quota left by Jason Garrett.
They lost Jason Garrett, so they wanted to bring him in. See, here's the thing, though. As far as Dak Prescott is concerned, I mean, at this point, it's like, okay, enough is enough. I mean, we want to play games. Here's the game. I'll sign the franchise tag this year. I'll play. I won't miss a game because I don't miss games. I'll have a great season with all these weapons. Then I'll sign another franchise tag, get my 70, whatever it is, guaranteed, and then I'll be a free agent. How's that game?
Be a good game.
That's
not like
a pretty
we haven't
game.
Seen a quarterback execute that same game plan. That's exactly what Kirk Cousins did with the Washington Redskins. How's that working out for him?
That's what I mean, though. Well, I mean, listen, if you want to play games like this, that's fine. I mean, Dak Prescott has stayed healthy. He hasn't missed one game. He's done everything you've asked him to do. Mm-hmm. He's been the face of your franchise. And now you want to play games. Okay, let's play a game. I'll sign my tag. I'll play. I'll sign another tag. And then I'll hit the market and see how much money I get paid.
I guess the question for me is why though? Why are they doing this? He's done everything you could possibly have asked for. They should have signed him last year. They've let it drag on. It's now becoming, I don't know, uncomfortable is the right word, but it's certainly a little bit awkward, and there's no end to this in sight. My question is why? Do they just not believe that he's the long-term answer quarterback?
Well, I don't think it's that they don't believe he's their franchise quarterback. I just think they've got a little bit of sticker shock when it comes to how much they're going to have to pay him in order to get a long-term deal done. I mean, Dave, we've been saying it. He's going to be the highest paid quarterback whenever he signs, and that means that he's going to be paid north of $35 million a year. And I mean, when you start talking about those type of numbers, it's going to give anybody pause in terms of evaluating the player and making sure that that guy is going to be worth every single dollar. But if you're Jerry Jones and you're trying to win a championship before you're no longer going to be the owner of the team, then it's a situation where you really don't have a whole lot of options. The Cowboys are right in the middle of their championship window. So, I mean, while everybody wants to say that the Andy Dalton signing gives the Cowboys more leverage in this situation, which I don't understand, it's ultimately about how can we win a championship, and clearly Dak Prescott is the Cowboys' best option based on what the marketplace is.
I mean, if Dak Prescott signs his franchise tag, I don't know where the leverage is at. Because, I mean, he'll play all the games. I mean, they just added CeeDee Lamb. He'll have a good season. We'll see what that translates into as far as wins and losses. And then we'll be back in this same situation.
Well, I think the question is, why hadn't he signed it yet? Like, if he hasn't signed it, what are we waiting on?
Well, because I think they're still negotiating. I don't know why he wouldn't sign it either. But, I mean, this is just Jerry Jones and the Cowboys realizing they made a mistake by not having a long-term deal wrapped up before mm-hmm. he played last season.
No, you're right. You're right. You're absolutely right. But I think people are saying that this Andy Dalton signing is going to be the push that Dak needs in order to get in there and sign this franchise tender, which I don't agree with.
I don't agree with that either.
Yeah.
Well, he's not going to sign it for this reason. And, Chris, you know this. You keep saying it. I mean, they changed the rules in the CBA. If you don't sign it, you can't get fined. So one of his leverage plays is I won't show up, then you can't sign it because you don't want to get fined the money. Once you sign it, they can start fining you when you don't show up.
100%.
So, I mean, it makes no sense to sign it because they're not going to rescind it.
No, they're not going to rescind it. That's not going to happen because at that moment, that's when you know that Dak Prescott at some point in the near future won't be the quarterback of the Dallas Cowboys. I think that's when it takes an ugly turn. Theoretically, could they do it? Yeah, but that's not going to happen. I think everybody understands that. But we're waiting until mid-July. I think July 15th is the date that they have to hammer out a contract extension. But if they don't get that done, then he's going to be forced to play the upcoming season on the franchise tag. And I think that's something that Dak Prescott can live with. Dallas Cowboys can probably live with it too. But what happens after that becomes the bigger question, because that number jumps from $31.4 million this year to a tag number of $37 million the following year if they're not able to work out a long-term agreement.
Yeah, it almost feels like Jerry Jones realizes he screwed up because he
didn't
get
this deal
done.
And like a child now, he's just going to double down on it?
Well, not even double down. I think, Zeke got paid too, but it took Zeke holding out. And we're not, we got till July 15th for a deal to get done. So once you realize you make a mistake and how much you're going to ultimately have to pay him, maybe his mindset, his business mindset is, at least for the next however long it is, go back and forth to see if we can get the best deal, as opposed to, I think we all understand, unless he plays under the franchise tag, once that deadline gets closer, then if they want to sign him long-term, something will get done.
Well, here's the problem with what you're saying, and I'm not saying you're wrong, but you're talking about a guy that's the face of your franchise. I've said it before, quarterbacks are closer to ownership than they are the other 52 guys in the locker room, and Dak Prescott is an extension of Jerry Jones. We saw it a couple of years back when you had the Colin Kaepernick controversy, and Dak Prescott stood in front of the media cameras and said on the record, this team is going to stand for the anthem, and supported the position of the owner. Those are the intangibles that Dak Prescott brings to the table, and that has real value in terms of dollars and cents for the organization. So with this situation right now, I don't understand why Jerry Jones and Stephen Jones keep going back and forth with this. This is one of those things where you got to go ahead and get the deal done. I know Jerry Jones is a hell of a businessman, but you can't win every single deal. This is not a deal that you're going to win. The win is making sure that you have Dak Prescott as your quarterback for the foreseeable future. And hopefully, with that being the case, you can capitalize on the talent that you have on this roster.
I actually don't think he's going to be the long-term quarterback of this team. I think he will be for a year or two, but I don't see 5 years down the road Dak Prescott as the quarterback of the Cowboys.
Why would you say that? Do you think he's not good enough?
No, I think he's fine. I think I don't understand what they're doing. I don't understand the rationale behind their games with him. He's terrific, right? Is he Mahomes? No. Is he a top three or five quarterback? No. But he's a good quarterback. You've won with him. Why, when it first came to it, would you not have signed him to a long-term deal? I don't understand why they're playing this game with him.
Well, I don't think it's a game, Dave. I don't think it's complicated. Dak Prescott wants to be the highest paid quarterback. We've seen it in the NFL before. When you're considered amongst the best at your position, and I know quarterback might be a little bit different, but when you're considered amongst the best, the next guy to get paid is going to be the highest paid. That's just how it works. Once upon a time, Matt Stafford was the highest paid quarterback, highest paid player in the National Football League. I don't think you could have found anybody at the time that says that Matt Stafford is the best player in the NFL, but was paid like
that. No, but get the deal done with him. Make him the highest paid quarterback. 10 minutes later, it'll be Mahomes. 15 minutes later, it's going to be someone else. And by the time you're 2 years down the road, you'll look at it and be like, it's not a bad deal that they wrapped up Dak Prescott to that deal.
No, I know it won't be a bad deal, Dave, but that's the problem that Jerry Jones and Stephen Jones are. That's their issue. They don't want to pay a guy more money than they think his value in terms of where he ranks positionally would suggest. They don't want to make him the highest paid quarterback in the NFL if he ain't the best quarterback in the NFL. That's what it is.
It's not how it works, though. Right?
I know it's not how it works, but Jerry and Steven are trying to sell Dak on, if you're the quarterback of the Cowboys, you can make money out off the field. You have endorsements. You have appearances. You've got a lot of things that you can do in order to capitalize on being the starting quarterback for our team. But Dak's like, that's all well and good, but I want to get my money from you. I want to be the highest paid player in the NFL, the highest paid player at my position, because I'm the next guy to get paid.
Yeah, but the reality is, if they do sign him, probably sooner is better than later, just because, he'll be the highest paid quarterback. Then all of a sudden, Deshaun Watson will negotiate with Bill O'Brien, and he'll be the highest paid quarterback. And then once he signs and Pat Mahomes gets his deal, he'll be the highest paid quarterback. I just think it's what you said. When Chris asked you about Dak Prescott, you said he's good, he's fine. Well, if that's the mindset, he's good, he's fine. And, the year he had his best statistical season, we didn't even make the playoffs. And we had a chance to win a game and make the playoffs. And Carson Wentz and an injury-ravaged Philadelphia Eagles team beat us. Do we need to pay him that kind of money in a salary cap sport? That could be the only question they're asking themselves at this point. Otherwise, the deal would be done.
Well, I think the Cowboys are looking at it kind of like a situation where it's like, is this guy Carson Wentz or is he closer to Joe Flacco? And when I bring up Joe Flacco, a guy that if the pieces are around him and he plays well at the right time, we can win a championship. But this is not a guy that can do what Carson Wentz did. We talk about late November, the team being 5-7 and being able to rattle off four straight wins and win the division and get into the postseason with a who's who cast of characters. Like that, I think that's what Jerry Jones and Stephen Jones are going back and forth on, because I don't think they believe that he's a guy that elevates the play of everybody around him like the best in the game. I think that they're a guy, they believe he's a guy that can win if you have enough of the right pieces around him. And that's why the Cowboys are trying to skimp a little bit on what they're going to pay him on a long-term deal, just because they recognize they've got to support him with some supremely talented players on the rest of the roster.
Which they have. All right. I mean, the offensive line has been one of the best in football. The running back is one of the best in football. I mean, they traded for Amari Cooper. They now drafted C.D. Lamb. I mean, they have done everything to make this guy succeed. And at some point, you're going to have to pay him. He if you rank him right now, he's what? The 10th best quarterback in the league somewhere, you know, 8, 10,
yeah, I'd say top 10, 12.
All right. Something like that. There's no way that you're going to be able to pay him as the 10th highest paid quarterback in the league. There is no way that would ever happen. So at some point, I seeing this continuing to get messier and messier, and I don't think it ends well for the Cowboys and Dak Prescott down the road.
Well, I mean, if the Cowboys are smart, it will end well, and he will be their quarterback for the foreseeable future. But, I mean, listen, if he plays this year under the franchise tag, I mean, either way, it's going to lead to the Cowboys paying a number that they're uncomfortable with. Because if you play it out, if he plays this year and they get to the postseason, they win a playoff game, then you've got to figure out, okay, we've got to get a long-term deal done. And at that time, you don't know whether or not Watson or Mahomes will have deals. But if they do get deals,
then you're even in worse shape.
Then you're in worse shape, because you're talking about, okay, Dak Prescott wanting to have more money than he's asking for right now. So, I mean, it's a situation where it doesn't matter what happens. The Cowboys, the longer they wait, are going to have to pay more money. And it just feels like Dak Prescott is the best available option for him in terms of who's going to be their guy.
I think the bigger question, though, too, is what keeps your championship window open the longest? Is it, you know, finding someone like Andy Dalton that is good and surrounded with, you know, all the right pieces, can be a winning quarterback that kind of already knows that he is, you know, he's an average quarterback, so he'll get paid like an average quarterback, as opposed to someone that you think is a top 12 quarterback that wants to be, you know, paid like a top 3 quarterback. I mean, if you took feelings out of it, let's be honest, if you take feelings completely out of this thing business-wise, it's in the Cowboys' best interest, especially now because you got, you know, a new head coach, for Dak to play under this franchise tag, see what he does with these weapons with a new head coach, and if he's, you know, as good as he's saying he is, and he has a ton of success this season, and you know make it to the NFC Championship game or whatever it is, then who cares how much money he wants? You'll feel good paying him.
What happens if you're somewhere in the middle? What happens if he has another terrific season, throws for 4,700 yards, throws for 35 touchdowns, doesn't play well in a huge game against the Eagles, doesn't go to the postseason, but puts up the numbers? Then what do you do?
Then what do you do? I think then that kind of makes it, I think it makes your decision easier if you're the Dallas Cowboys.
Yeah, because you're not going to extend a franchise tag paying them $37 million in order to buy time to negotiate a long-term deal.
And how about the flip side of that? How about he has a decent season, but you go to the NFC Championship game? Then do you pay him, or do you say, you know what, we would have gone there, you know, whether he was our quarterback or not?
Well, I mean, if he wins a playoff game, then he's going to be the quarterback of the Dallas Cowboys in 2021. By franchise tag or by long-term deal, it's going to happen. But if he doesn't win a playoff game, if they don't get to the playoffs, then I think that's a different conversation. But I have a hard time believing that the Cowboys won't be able to bounce back and get to the postseason based on the things that they've done this offseason, from hiring Mike McCarthy to drafting CeeDee Lamb and having the draft class that they had and hitting on all those positions. I just feel like the Cowboys are one of the most talented teams in a field full of talented teams in the NFC. And when you're talking about expanded playoffs and 7 teams getting in, I have a hard time believing the Cowboys won't be one of them.
It just feels like an odd time to rock the boat. I mean, with where this Dallas Cowboys team is at. Like, I mean, this is when you'd want less noise, like the least amount of noise, the least amount of distraction.
Yeah, it's winning time. This is it. They got to get it done. This is a two, like we said it last year, it's a 2 or 3 year window that the Cowboys have to win a championship before they're going to have to break it up. Before you start getting to the latter part of the deals that they just signed with Amari Cooper and Ezekiel Elliott and all of those other guys. Like, you've got to do that now. If it doesn't happen now, then you're going to have to tear it down and retool on the fly. The question is, who's going to be the focal point that you're going to rebuild around? It should be Dak Prescott, but if they don't get a long-term deal done, then I don't know where the Dallas Cowboys go if they don't win a championship after the next couple of seasons.
So obviously the passing of Don Shula, 90 years old, earlier today, and thought it'd be a good idea to kind of reflect and reminisce, and who better to do that with than longtime Dolphins tight ends coach, special teams coach, and friend of our station and our program, Mike Westhoff. Good morning, Mike. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm fine, guys. Thank you. How are you guys doing?
We're doing the best we can. We're all locked away and trying to produce the best radio we can in a non-sports world. So
I'm doing the same thing.
Yeah, we all are just kind of keeping our head above water best as possible. So you know, give us some insight. I mean, you coached with Coach Shula for a long time. Give us some insight into what he was like, into the kind of coach he was, and who maybe you'd even compare him to in this generation of coaches that people kind of relate him to.
I'm not going to compare him to anyone in this generation. I'm sorry. I'm just not. I mean, the game was different back then when I entered in 1982. And then I got a call from Don Shula I guess it was 85, to come down to Miami. And I spent all this time. I mean, that was like getting a call. If you were a priest, that'd be like when the Pope called you. And it was the same thing. I was so proud of it. He ran, in a lot of ways, you could almost say like he was the NFL. I mean, he was a permanent member of the competition committee. He was involved in every legal aspect, the rules, financial dealings. I mean, to me, he was like the head of the officials, the commissioner, and the head coach of the entire league. That's just how he had a role in every aspect of it, and he was very involved. I always use the example, and I felt like in my business, the business I was in for 32 years, he was first. And nobody was second. That's just how I feel. Because he did so many things as a coach that so many other coaches don't do. I mean, he could coach every position. And he ran the draft. He could coach special teams. You know, I think I ended up becoming a pretty good one doing that. And a lot of it, I learned so much from him. Now, I took it and expanded it, which you had to do. But he studied everything. People don't know this. You know, we had a brilliant offense. I mean, he's one of those innovators. You know, when he was back with the Baltimore Colts, they had the great running game. And then when he was at Miami with Larry Zonka and Jim Kick, and then all of a sudden Dan Marino. But he was the offensive coordinator. He called the plays from the sideline with no script. He called them from his head. Now, he had a script stuck in his back pocket. And he pulled up, and Don Strzok helped him, yes, of course. But Don did all that. I mean, he would draw. He could get on the board and draw anything. And so when you coached for him, you really learned. You learned a great deal because, in fact, he made you learn. You know, you had to – all the rules, everything, you had to know the rules, how it was taught. He managed the game, clock management, timeout, substitutions. He was outstanding at all of it. But the thing that I learned from him – is that he never stopped working. I remember hearing a draft meeting one time, and we had finished up the night before the draft, and one of our scouts, a veteran scout, and he said to Don, he said, are we ready? And he said, oh, yeah. He said, yeah, Coach, the hay's in the barn. Oh, he should have jumped off the bridge rather than said that. Coach Shula, he gave him such a lecture, the hay's never in the barn. And he said, every single second, he wanted to study and to keep learning and it was really an interesting – it was not easy to work for him back then. It was tough. I mean, he made you earn everything. But once you did and you established yourself, which I did with him, then he was tremendous to me, just tremendous to me. He was like a second father to me.
Wesley, that's the question I wanted to ask you. I mean, you just mentioned what made him a great coach and all the preparation and everything else. I mean, what was he like as a guy? Like, as far as, you know, your personal relationship with him?
Well, he was great to me. He was always he would always ask me things, but he was never asking you. He was, you know, I'd be going with him and he'd say, like, Mike, you're going to get a car, right? In other words, Mike, get the damn car because I'm driving with you. That's what he's saying. We would go on the road and we'd have a meeting. Well, I remember in a playoff game one year, we were in a hotel, we were on the road, and we walked into this room. Everybody, he wanted to make sure you sat at a certain seat. And I sat at the head of the table opposite him, always. And someone was sitting in that seat. And he looked at him and he went, what the hell are you doing there? Poor guy. You know, I had to jump out of the seat, and he was in my seat. And it's just the way he was. You know, he'd say to me, Mike, you're going to take the second bus, right? In other words, Mike, get your ass on the second bus, because that's where I'm going. You know, and that's just the way. But, you know, he just did so many good things. He was a man's man. But the thing I always learned and liked more about him and respected is, as tough as he could be, and trust me, believe me, he could be a tough guy, he was so fair. He was very fair. He was fair with the players. He was fair with the coaches. You know, I've worked for some coaches, and actually I'm going to talk about this a little bit. I'm writing a book right now, which I'm going to expect all you guys to read and help me out. But it's going to be pretty cool because I'm putting a lot into it. I'm really enjoying it. But one of the things that with Coach Shula that you learned, that I learned, was just the way he was so fair in how he treated people. And he was always one to not just going to come in and fire somebody, but he would figure out how to solve the problem. I mean, he lets you know what the problem was and how we could handle it. Now, you damn sure better do it. You better do it or you're in trouble. But that's the way he did it. It wasn't like he fired a million coaches or things like that. That wasn't him. But trust me, you know, when he came walking down the hall, you know, you'd want to get under your desk and hide like George Costanza did back those old signposts. You just want to hide under there when he was coming looking for you because you knew you were in trouble. But I had a chair in my office, this big easy chair, that I would only let him sit in it. And he'd come in every Wednesday at exactly 6:30. He'd walk in my office. And he'd say, okay. Now, he would let me pretty much do everything. We'd go over the depth chart, and he let me coach everything except one thing he loved, and that was how to punt blocks. And he'd walk in, I'd have stuff drawn. He'd sit in that chair, and he'd turn around and say, okay, what do we got? And we'd start, on football. And I learned all the little basis of how to do every little thing from step by step by step. And I think it's one of the reasons why, I don't know, I think maybe I blocked more than anybody in NFL history, but that's where I learned it from, and I learned it from that the way he did it. And I never let anyone sit in that chair. And I'll never forget after he retired, and he did not want to come by the offices. He did not have the best relationship with Jimmy Johnson and those new guys. And he used to call me, and he'd say, would you tell the rest of those guys I don't work there anymore? Quit talking about what I'm doing. Anyway, he came by, and he'd sit down in that chair, and he'd sit around and say, okay, what do we got? And he's already retired. I was with the Jets. We blocked the punt on a Monday night. I got a call on a Tuesday night from Don Shula. He said, how'd you do it? What'd you do? He said, I saw it on TV. Break it down. And I would draw it up on a damn board. And I'm in New York, and he's in Miami. He was that brilliant of a coach that he could take anything and dissect it. And as a guy, you know, once you kind of earned your stripes with him, and trust me, I'm gonna write a lot about that in the book because I've got incredible stories to tell about it, and people will not know. There's a couple that are just going to knock people out because it's just really something special. But he was so fair as a person, and he saw so many different things and different ways to do it, and he would always hear you out. He would always say, okay. And his big thing was he'd look at you and say, it's hard not to know, but you damn sure better find out. And I did my whole career based with that. So,
Westy, I know the biggest part of Don Shula's legacy will be the relationships that he had with the players, the coaches, the men that he's worked with, and how he's impacted their lives. But I want to ask you about how Don Shula impacted the way the game was played. I mean, before him, I mean, the NFL was in large part four yards in a cloud of dust with the running game. But, I mean, he was really one of the first people to embrace throwing the ball around the yard, you know, being one of these high-powered offenses. I mean, it was really him, and I guess you would say Don Coryell, Eric Coryell. But, I mean, can you talk about how you see the influence of Don Shula in today's game?
Sure. Don Shula was big at trying to improve anything, any part. He would take it, he would break it down, and he would study what other people did. You know, I mean, he wasn't going to let Bill Walsh get up on him. He would study it. He would take a look, and he'd make sure there was always the door was closed. May was never in the barn with Coach Shula. He always wanted, and he wasn't afraid to try anything. He knew he had, you know, we had Dan Marino, and we could do anything we wanted with such an incredible worker. And so, you know, he wanted to make sure of how do we do these things. You know, well, I remember when we played the Bears that year, the great 85 Bears, and we beat them on that Monday night. You know, he came in and figured out that, you know, we could put Nat Moore in the backfield. And now they had to cover him from the line of scrimmage. They had no chance. They had no chance. They couldn't do it. He was smart enough to constantly work to try to see if you could do something better. And if you disagreed with them, it's okay, but you better prove your point. I remember getting up on that board. I'm going to tell you, my heart was beating right through my chest. But all of a sudden, there he's sitting down. Well, show me what you want to do here. Oh, I might have a heart attack. But it's how you learn. But the point was, he never, ever, ever said it was okay. Let's always see if we can't do it a little bit better. Whether it was to run, to play any part of the game, he was just such a student of the game. That's why I've referred to him a million times. You know, I think he's first and nobody second. That's just how I feel, and I will never get away from that because he saw all aspects of it. He was always, if you should have heard his conversations with the head of officiating, I can't think of his name right now. I'm trying to tip my tongue. Anyway, oh, my goodness gracious. It would be tough. It would be hard. It would be hard to deal with because he was such an expert on everything. And officiating, the way the league was handled. But the point is, with someone like Don Shula, nothing was ever at rest. He was always trying to find a better way and to figure it out. It's the thing I respected about him the most because it was never a status. And that's why you asked me how he wasn't afraid, you know, the 3 yards in a cloud of dust. Art McNally, when he would talk to poor Art, oh, my God, because he was tough. But he was smart, and he was fair. He was fair. And it's just the way he did things. But always, always, always accepted the challenge of there's a better way to do it. And if someone else was doing it better, that's okay. But believe me, he was going to figure it out. He was going to find out. And that we that worked for him, we're always under that. And I think it's what really helped me in my career because I never stopped trying to do something different. And I think it's the thing that I did exceptionally well, and I got it right sitting right there with him every single second.
Mike Westhoff with us here, 98.7 ESPN. So I watched a lot of these documentaries, and there was one on Nick Bonacani and one on Larry Zonk, and just the reverence, Coach, that they speak of when they talk about Don Shula. Players that, you know, played for him years and years and years ago still hold him in this unbelievable high regard. I mean, it felt like, and maybe I'm wrong, that the guys just absolutely adored playing for him. And even when they were done playing in the game, that never ceased.
Well, one of the parts adored would be an interesting way of saying it, because trust me, when you walk off the practice field, a lot of times those guys, it wasn't that they adored him then. Mm. And they were ready to kill him. They were mad. He was tough. But he was always so fair, and they always saw the result of what he was trying to do. Always, you could always see that. I'll never forget one of the first things he told me was that we were looking at, you know, I was going to warm up and practice the warm up, and how we were, you know, pre-practice and drills and blocking sleds and all that type of thing. And he made it very clear to me. He said, "Don't ever let me see you doing a mindless drill. Ever." I had to coach the offensive line for him for a long time. Our offensive line coach was ill, and I took over at times and did it. And I would be, guys were going to block the seven-man sled. Now, I couldn't say, okay, let's go right shoulder. No, I had to call a play in which they knew then what shoulder to block with. It was never a mindless drill. Not one thing ever, ever, ever. Like, I was not a big drill guy. Even when I went to the Saints a couple years ago, they were talking about we're going to do some drills. I said, no, not with me. I don't do any of that. All I know is we went from 31st to first, so I know it works, and that's where I got it from. From his attention to detail, and the players knew that. Plus, he treated them fairly, and he treated them like men. That's why they respected him. Believe me, he could be hard. Oh, he could be tough. His practices were really difficult, although I think people could learn, because his training camp practices were as tough as you could ever be a part of. Never on the field more than an hour and 25 minutes. Never. But that hour and 25 minutes, whoa, you better muster everything up that you had, because it was tough. But that, he just understood that. And at the end of the day, to answer your question, all of those guys knew that everything he did was in benefit of that football team winning and them improving. He relished their successes. He really relished it. And he was exceptional at that. And I think until forever, people appreciate that. I know it's what I gained from him all those years, and I feel so grateful that I had that tremendous time with him, both on the field and off the field, and it's something that will hold an incredible place in my life.
Westy, last one for me. I kind of want to ask you how fishing's going, but I'll keep this related to the topic that we're the way you describe him and your relationship, and it's one thing that, you know, I feel like a lot of coaches miss out on or don't, you know, put enough emphasis on. It sounds like that Don Shula made it a point to really get to know each one of his individual players and kind of create that bond, create that trust, that everything he was, you know, everything he was preaching, everything he was doing was in their best interest, opposed to kind of, you know, it's my way of doing things, it's my system, and overlook that, you know, that relationship that the greats have with their players.
Well, I think the fact that you could see that he wasn't afraid to change. I mean, he could change something instantly. And he could go from being a running team, just, you know, with Larry Zonka and Jim kicking to blast the ball in there, to all, and then to a team that went to the Super Bowl without a veteran quarterback, to all of a sudden here comes Dan Marino. You know, all of a sudden we're throwing the ball better than anyone.
Westy, I got to ask you this question. I know that you said you're not going to compare Don Shula to anybody in this era, but you did talk about his mindset being progressive, forward-thinking, being willing to adapt and change. Do you look out at any coaches in today's game and see some of those same traits?
Did we lose Coach? We lost him? All right. Well, you know what? He gave us such an insight into Don Shula, and we certainly appreciate a couple minutes there for that. And he really, talk about, and Mike Westhoff is a coach's coach. You hear how choked up he was about the passing of Don Shula, because that's the way they all felt is he was a larger than life character. He was a great coach. He was a great man. He had a long storied life. I mean, really, 90 years old, coached forever, won Super Bowls, great family man. Like, Chris, he really had everything you could ask for.
No, he had everything you could ask for. And I know a lot of people will spend time focusing on the perfect season and all of the things that Don Shula did to revolutionize the game. But it was clear in listening to Westy talk that the coaches, along with the players that worked with Don Shula, I mean, the lasting impact, the lasting legacy, the thing that they'll hold on to the most is how he treated them and how he engaged them, mm-hmm. You know, the back and forth. And I think that's important when you start talking about today's game and today's athlete and just having a coach that is receptive to input and not being so rigid, so stuck in their ways, but being willing to hear everyone out. You know, at least allowing the athlete to know that they're seen, allowing your coaches to recognize that you value their contributions. I think that's important in terms of trying to establish a championship organization.
And today on ESPN Daily, in The Last Dance, Michael Jordan confirmed, he said the infamous quote, "Republicans buy sneakers too." The story, the ripple effects of those words decades later in Jordan's politics, then and now. That's on ESPN Daily. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcast. I mean, he is almost, Rick, out of central casting, Mike Westhoff. He is a football coach's football coach.
Yeah, he's the best. I mean, Chris and I spent pretty much our entire trip down to the Super Bowl in Houston with Coach Westhoff. I mean,
he has more stories than anyone I've ever met.
Chris, that one night we closed down that steak place, what was it, 3-4 hours we talked to him?
Yeah, I mean, it was 2 a.m. when they closed. So yeah, and we got there probably around 9:00. Then we started hanging out with Westy around 10:30, and we stayed until the place closed.
But don't you, but it's always so like topical and it's always so interesting. And it's just like everything he says, I'm just so intrigued by it. He's just such an interesting character.
Well, during the break, I was actually talking to him on the phone because I wanted an answer to the question that I asked him last before we got disconnected, and just listening to how he talks about Don Shula to show that type of reverence for somebody. I mean, that just lets you know how much of an impact Don Shula had on Westhoff's coaching career, but I'm sure countless others. The people that he worked with in the National Football League, with the Miami Dolphins, the Baltimore Colts. I mean, there aren't enough words to describe what Don Shula meant to the game of football. And I guess we have to just stand back and appreciate, you know, what he contributed and how he changed the game, how he revolutionized the game. But I mean, Dave, we were talking about the true sign of greatness with Michael Jordan and how they fundamentally changed the way the game is played. I think the same applies with Don Shula in terms of what the NFL was before him and what the NFL is now.
Let's go to a couple calls, 800-919-3776. And then we're going to have the athletic director of LIU on with us, Dr. William Martinoff at noon. Why specifically, Rick? Why specifically will he join us right at the top of the noon hour? Because LIU is launching a new Division I hockey program.
Yeah, it's exciting.
Very
absolutely
exciting.
I mean, I'm actually nervous for this interview, to be honest.
This really is going to be an interview.
No, I mean, you're going to listen. This is going to be, I mean, this is, first of all, I mean, I've been saying it for how long? I mean, Long Island needs a program like this. So the fact that it's happening and we have, you know, some of the best people, on the planet that work for us. And it just so happens that, you know, this news comes out and Ray Dinahan, our producer, just on his own gets the AD. I mean, this is why I love my job. This is why I love you people. You guys are great. Yeah.
Yep. So he's going to join us in about 6 minutes from right now. Let's go to Andre in Westchester. Andre, you're next up on 98.7.
Yeah, good morning. Good afternoon, you guys. First time in a long time. You guys made some great points. I just wanted to touch on two quick things. One, Don Shula, like, I'm a younger guy. Don Shula was one of the first coaches that I saw on television that seemed like a player's coach. It just seemed like so many people loved it. This is back in the 70s. I may have been 10 years old. And he just had so much calm but intensity to him. And I can see why he's revered, you know. And so I just love the points that were made about him earlier. The other thing I just want to touch on is about Dak Prescott and the Cowboys. I mean, I'm a lifelong Cowboys fan. He is the quarterback for this team. However, these guys need to win. The Cowboys, since the Michael Irvin and Troy Aikman era, they've had one team, I feel like, who could have gone to the Super Bowl. That was the year that Dez Bryant dropped.
When he dropped the ball, yeah.
When he dropped the ball, right?
Yeah.
Since then, I mean, all this time, they haven't had anybody to bring them over the top. The only person who had that personality in the way that Michael Irvin had that personality was Dez Bryant. I don't think there's been anybody else there. And I think that what Jerry Jones is wanting to see if Dak can really bring this team over the top. From his leadership, from his play on the field, he's great off the field.
So how long is he going to wait for, Andre? I mean, you might not have the answer by the time you want to get him signed to a long-term deal.
No. So this is exactly my point, and which you guys did touch on a little bit. I'm glad because I've been waiting for weeks for people to say this, and I finally heard you guys say it. This team has a two-year to maybe three-year window. And so when I say that, if you look at the long-term contracts, they're all guaranteed, except for Ezekiel Elliott, I think, beyond 2 years. They're going to franchise Dak this year if he doesn't sign a reasonable long-term deal. And they'll franchise him again next year. And if they don't get it done, they're going to blow this team up.
Yeah, they very well might. Andre, we got to run. We appreciate the phone call.
DiPietro, Canty, and Rothenberg. Weekdays at 10 on 98.7 ESPN.